to go? Great. Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to see you all this morning as we tackle the second half of Hebrews 12. Now, I discovered something about myself, actually many things about myself, as I was preparing this talk, but I wonder if one of them is true about you, too. I discovered that I love invitations. Whether it's a last-minute text from my husband saying the weather is great, let's take a walk, or an invite from a friend for their milestone birthday party, or one of those colorful postcards telling me to save the date, invitations are fun. But with every invitation, comes the need to respond. And while the how-tos of RSVPs have shifted somewhat over the last couple of years, for the most part, it's still true. If your host doesn't know to expect you, you'll probably miss out on the fun. And Randy Alcorn's book, Heaven, includes a little story at the beginning that proves that point. It was shared by a woman named Ruthanna Metzger. Now, Ruthanna is a professional singer, and at one point in her career, she was invited to perform at the wedding of a very wealthy man. The reception afterward was being held at a very lavish downtown Seattle hotel. And as Ms. Metzger and her husband ascended the staircase leading up to the penthouse where the reception was being held, they were dazzled by the sights around them as the reception was unfolding. At the top of the staircase, a maitre d' asked for their names to check them off the guest list. And that's what they discovered, that despite repeated attempts, they were not in his book. And as after the last try, and they still couldn't find them, the couple were escorted down back to the servant's entrance and downstairs to the parking garage. Now, on the way home, the husband turned to his wife and said, "Sweetheart, what happened?" And that's when she confessed to him that when the invitation came, she was busy, and she forgot to send in the RSVP, and it never occurred to her that since she was already performing at the wedding, that she would need to RSVP. And she started to cry, and she said, she was crying not only because they'd missed this wonderful reception, but because it gave her for the first time a small taste of what it would be like to be in front of Jesus and realize that your name is not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Now, the second half of Hebrews 12 invites us into God's unshakable kingdom, Mount Zion and the New Jerusalem. It's the prize that the last two chapters have been pointing us towards, and the writer wants to make sure that we get to claim it. These final 15 verses of the chapter pull together and revisit many of the book's earlier thematic threads. They take us back to the Old Testament, to places and to events that point to Christ, his ministry, and show us how they can dramatically impact our Christian walk, both now and in eternity. Some of the specific themes that were introduced just last week include: fix your eyes on Christ, run the race he set for you, flee sin, and shake off every encumbrance. Run with hope and perseverance, knowing that a harvest of righteousness awaits you. Now, I'll begin today's lesson by reading Hebrews 12, 14 to 29 from Eugene Peterson's translation, The Message. Work at getting along with each other and with God. Otherwise, you'll never get so much as a glimpse of God. Make sure no one gets left out of God's generosity. Keep a sharp eye out for weeds of discontent. A thistle or two gone to seed can ruin a whole garden in no time. Watch out for the Esau syndrome, trading away God's lifelong gift in order to satisfy a short-term appetite. You well know how Esau later regretted that impulsive act and wanted God's blessing. But by then it was too late, tears or no tears. Unlike your ancestors, you didn't come to Mount Sinai, all the volcanic blaze and earth-shaking rumble, to hear God speak. The ear-splitting words and soul-shaking message terrified them, and they begged him to stop. When they heard the words, "If an animal touches the mountain, it's as good as dead," they were afraid to move. Even Moses was terrified. No, that's not your experience at all. You've come to Mount Zion, the city where the living God resides. The invisible Jerusalem is populated by throngs of festive angels and Christian citizens. It is the city where God is judge, with judgments that make us just. You've come to Jesus, who presents us with a new covenant, a fresh charter from God. He is the mediator of this covenant. The murder of Jesus, unlike Abel's, a homicide that cried out for vengeance, became a proclamation of grace. So don't turn a deaf ear to those gracious words. If those who ignored earthly warnings didn't get away with it, what will happen to us if we turn our backs on heavenly warnings? His voice, that time, shook the earth to its foundations. This time, he's told us quite plainly, he'll rock the heavens. One last shaking, from top to bottom, stem to stern. The phrase, "one last shaking," means a thorough house cleaning, getting rid of all the historical and religious junk so that the unshakable essentials stand clear and uncluttered. Do you see what we've got? An unshakable kingdom. And do you see how thankful we must be? Not only thankful, but brimming with worship, deeply reverent before God. For God is not an indifferent bystander. He is actively cleaning house, torching all that needs to burn, and he won't quit until it's all cleansed. God himself is fire. I want to begin by focusing on the image of the city of God, the invisible Jerusalem that is populated by myriads of angels, fellow by believers, by God, the church triumphant, and by Jesus himself. It is full of life, joy, and overflowing with the forgiveness that marks the covenant of grace. For Christians, it's a reality, not just for eternity, but right now. And I put that vision right out in front of us all at the beginning, so that it's tucked away in the back of your head as we deal with the harder parts of this passage. Dear sisters, we will be facing head-on the reality of conflict among believers. We'll dissect temptations that lead to compromise and understand how grace can deal a death blow to bitterness. We will marvel at the faith of a persecuted 21st century church, and we will discover that by God's grace, all things are possible as long as we never forget the glorious vision of what God has in store for us. What happens when we lose sight of that vision, of that goal? Well, here's one example. On a foggy morning, July 4th, 1952, a famous long-distance swimmer named Florence Chadwick waded into the water off Catalina Island near California. Her goal was to swim the channel from that island to the California coast. Now, she was no novice when it came to challenging athletic feats and had already swum. She'd been the first woman to swim the English Channel in both directions. Now, the water in the channel off Catalina that morning was cold and shark infested. The fog was thick, and after an exhausting swim of more than 15 hours, she asked to be taken out of the water, even though her coach assured her that land was less than a mile away. Later she said, "I'm not excusing myself, but if I could just have seen the land, I would have made it." Now, many times we fail just because we can't see how close to the goal we really are. Maybe that's what the Apostle Paul had in mind when he said in Philippians 3:14, "I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus." And just as an aside, it may encourage you to know that just 2 months after her defeat off Catalina Island, Florence Chadwick waded back into the same channel and swam the same distance, setting a new speed goal because she could see the land. So with our eyes on the prize, let's plunge into the passage. Verses 14 to 15 urge us to strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. Now that's a tall order, but it's an important one. Conflict between believers, whether it's within couples, within families, or between believers in the same church, is a great way to glorify Satan, to disgrace God, and to discredit our Christian witness. R. Kent Hughes says that pursuing peace or making every effort to get along with others, as it's described here, is actually a uniquely aggressive action. And it is literally calling us to chase after one's enemies or to chase after peace. It is much like Paul's urging in Ephesians 4:3 to make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. It all comes down to the choices we make. Those who chase after peace will choose to forgive, will choose to forget, will choose to help others, and will choose to pray for their enemies. As they do that, they help build a community that is strong, resilient, and uniquely able to help its members cope with attacks from the outside. Susie Eller, a staff writer with Proverbs 31 Ministries, recently wrote a blog post highlighting some specific ways that women weaken community by speaking destructively of one another. Speaking against the spiritual injury that such behavior causes, she urges us instead to use our words in a way that encourages our faith walk. Why do we judge each other so harshly, she asks. Maybe it's because we've forgotten how powerful we can be together. The need for corporate strength and perseverance is behind the writers urging us to see to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. In light of the temptations that these Jewish believers faced, the writer knows that at any moment, someone might fall behind or drop out of the race altogether. That's why in chapter 2, he warns of believers drifting away on a wave of worldly unbelief. In chapter 3, he warns against the deceitfulness of sin that can harden the heart and pull people away from the living God. Finally, in chapter 10, he urges believers to cultivate the endurance needed to do the will of God and receive what is promised. Verse 15 in chapter 12 warns of another danger. Let no root of bitterness spring up, cause trouble, and defile many. This warning refers back to Deuteronomy 29, where Moses says, "Beware, lest there be among you a man or a woman or clan or tribe whose heart is turning away from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of other nations. Beware, lest there be among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit, one who, when he hears the words of this sworn covenant, blesses himself in his heart and says, 'I shall be safe, though I walk in the stubbornness of my own heart.'" What a bad idea. A bitter and resentful person, the ESV Study Bible says, is like a contagious poison, spreading his resentment to others. Which brings us to what our passage describes as the Esau syndrome. Esau's life, as described beginning in verse 16, gives us a great example of what happens when bitterness takes over a person's life. The writer describes him as trading away God's lifelong gift in order to satisfy a short-term appetite. You well know, the writer warns, how Esau later regretted that impulsive act and wanted God's blessing, but by then it was too late. Tears are no tears. Now, we know that Esau was the firstborn son of Jacob and Rebekah. He was destined to inherit the family wealth and carry on the family line. But even before he was born, it was prophesied that his younger brother Jacob would rule over him. Esau grew up to be unstable, hot-tempered, impulsive, and angry. One scholar describes him as a big, hairy, red-headed man who built his life around fun, i.e. hunting, not what I would call fun, fun, food, and females. He could have been named Big Red, which is what his name Edom meant. And he probably could have been the star of his own line of beer commercials. Genesis 26 tells us that Esau also married pagan women and made his parents' life miserable. Now, Esau's goals and cravings were completely earthbound. He seems to have turned his back on the godly values that motivated his parents. The sexual and physical appetites that ruled him eventually left spiritual deficits that made his relinquishing his birthright the natural next step. Genesis 25:29 describes the event in this way. And when Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am about to die. So what use is the birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "First, swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Years after he rejected his birthright, the covenant blessing was also given to his brother Jacob. Esau then regretted having given away something of such value, but he never turned away from the path of sinfulness that had caused him to reject it. Think of how much Esau gave up for just a few moments of satisfaction. He sacrificed God's rich promises in the long term for what felt good for a moment. He turned his back on who he was to satisfy an appetite. And I'm sure that Esau's disregard for his birthright would have been a timely and important example for the Christians who were running their race in the midst of many hardships, real persecution, as well as cultural distractions. But how relevant is it for us? Well, it forces me to ask, in what area of my life do I tend towards anger, immorality, or godlessness? When I find myself getting angry, am I protecting some behavior, some affection, some idolatry that crowds out Jesus? Where does what I crave crowd out who I am in Jesus? And where am I controlled by what is present, horizontal, and passing away, instead of what is eternal? This passage urges us further. Let no one miss the grace of God as Esau did. Now, I may look on in disbelief as Esau sells his eternal spiritual inheritance to temporarily silence a physical craving. Yet in his actions, I see the seeds of the same bitterness in my own heart. And we've already seen how bitterness in someone can pollute the faith of an entire community. One commentator wisely observed that bitterness and grace cannot coexist. One must flourish at the expense of the other. And the perfect way to push bitterness out of my life is to remember the grace of God that has been lavished on me. As soon as I find myself preoccupied with how someone has sinned against me, I need to refocus my mind on what Jesus has done for me. Realizing that Jesus doesn't make me pay for the ways I've sinned against him, I need to extend the same grace to those towards whom I might harbor bitterness. In her recent blog post, The Satisfaction of Seduction, Lisa Turkhurst shares some powerful insights that can protect us from the same short-term compromise that accumulated and eventually caused Esau to miss God's best. She shares the temptation of any kind is Satan's invitation to get our needs met outside of the will of God, and that we can expose Satan's clever and crafty message as soon as we understand the difference between a need and a want. She reminds us that God's provision satisfies the soul in the short term and will reap blessings in the long term. On the other hand, Satan's temptations in the short term not only leave us feeling empty in the short term, but they reap heartache in the long term. And she points out, I thought this was very clever, that the word promise is right there in the midst of the word compromise. And she urges us to ask in the midst of a decision, any decision, am I holding fast to God's promise, or am I being lured by a compromise? So, dear sisters, let's be real with one another. When God calls us to a task that we don't feel up to, when we engage in a conflict with someone we love, or when we feel battered by everyday life, where do we turn? Specifically in my life, I have to ask myself, do I open up my bruised heart to Jesus and allow him to do his work, or do I turn to a soothing, sweet snack, the escape of a cozy mystery novel, or a single-click Amazon purchase? I'll be honest, running the race that has been set for me, hugging my lane, and persevering through God's timely discipline doesn't soothe me in the short term. It exposes my sin, it exposes my insecurities, and it exposes my idolatries. But if I seek the Lord and accept his promise of deliverance over a quick fix compromise, I have found that eventually I grow a stronger character and I bear enduring spiritual fruit. And that is worth praising God for. The book of Hebrews, as we've discovered, is part travelogue, taking us back and forth between the Old and the New Testaments as we discover all the ways in which Christ's life, his work, and his sacrifice are better in every way than the covenant of the law. And this chapter is no exception. We now come to two dramatic and contrasting images, that of Mount Sinai, symbolizing the covenant of the law, and Mount Zion, the covenant of grace. First, back to Genesis. After God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, he brought them to the mountain where he dwelt so that they could worship him. The description in Hebrews 12, 18-24 refers us back to Exodus 19:12, where God tells Moses the conditions under which the Israelites can approach the mountain. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch it, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. God comes down to Mount Sinai to give the Israelites the Ten Commandments. And when the Israelites approach the mountain, the voice and the presence of God terrify them, because those two things expose their sinfulness. Even Moses trembles. The writer of Hebrews focuses on a series of dramatic images, piling them one upon the other to increase the terrible spectacle. We see the mountain, the fire, the gloom and darkness that engulf it, a whirlwind, a trumpet blast, and a voice they can't bear to hear. The mountain is wrapped in darkness and gloom. The people come to God under the old covenant, and because they can't bear to hear God's voice, they send Moses up the mountain to mediate for them. The blazing fire brings to mind the blazing sword held by the angel that guarded the gate to the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve's fall and barred man's access to God. The images considered together capture the experience of the Israelites at Mount Sinai under the Mosaic covenant. Having painted this terrifying picture, the writer quickly adds, but you have not come to that mountain, but instead to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. Unlike Mount Sinai, the mountain of grace where God's people dwell is a scene of tremendous encouragement and blessing. And it is the coming of Christ that has made all the difference. You have come, verse 22 points out, to innumerable angels in vestal gathering. We learn in Hebrews chapter 2 that the old covenant was given through angels, but these were clothed in darkness and gloom, and they sounded the trumpets and fed the fires of Mount Sinai. But now they are the welcoming party, ushering in the assembly of the firstborn to the city of Jerusalem. Now, what does it mean to be enrolled in heaven among the assembly of the firstborn? In the Old Testament, heirs received their portion by birth, not by achievement. The firstborn received a double portion of the inheritance, and in this context, the firstborn gain access to their status solely by faith. In his commentary, Rick Phillips says, "These citizens are those beloved of God, defended and delivered by his might for fellowship with him and to worship with him forever." Matthew 25:34 echoes this when it says, "Come, ye blessed of the Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundations of the world." So we have come to a new mountain with new inhabitants, all made possible by Jesus, the new mediator. On Mount Sinai, Moses was the mediator who braved the darkness, the fire, and the trumpet blast to intercede for Israel in fear and trembling. Jesus is now the mediator of the new covenant made possible by his sacrifice and his blood. This covenant quenches fire and strips away the clouds of God's wrath, so that the gates of paradise can now be thrown open for all who come in faith. Verse 24 offers us one more way that Christ's blood offers us a better word. After going back to Genesis, this time to chapter 4, the writer refers us to the story of Abel, one of Adam and Eve's children, who was killed by his older brother Cain. After the murder, God pursues Cain, saying, "The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground." But whereas God curses Cain and Abel's blood calls out, for vengeance, Christ's blood now cries out for peace and forgiveness. R. Kent Hughes sums it up well. What a vision we have. We are bequeathed from Calvary. God, with his arms nailed wide as if to embrace all those who have come to him. Mount Zion, crowned by Golgotha, shows us God. Both mountains, Sinai and Zion, reveal God. The covenant of the law and the covenant of grace each play their part in the salvation story. And they remind us that God is both consuming fire and consuming love. Hebrews 12 draws to a close with a final warning. "See that you do not refuse him who is speaking," and warns that before eternity is ushered in, the heavens and the earth will be shaken. Studying this chapter has shown me some specific ways that my heart can get sidetracked and that I can miss the invitation that I've been offered. I'm reminded of the phrase from the hymn, "Come, thou fount of every blessing." Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Easily distracted by temptation, easily discouraged by the Lord's discipline, I need to be mentored by fellow believers, my personal cloud of witnesses, who fuel my push to the finish line. One body of believers that especially inspires me is a church of people that I will probably never meet. They are in Aleppo, Syria, and I heard about them in a blog post last November on a site called the World Watch Monitor. This church is included among the remnant of 20,000 to 40,000 Christians who remain among what used to be a body of 200,000 Christians in Aleppo before the war started. So you can do the math. 220,000. I applaud their courage and the courage in staying behind. Now, one congregation among these 20,000 help about 2,000 families every month with food, medical supplies, and rental assistance. Their bold and courageous love in the midst and the death and the horror that surrounds them each day is having an impact both on believers and on non-believers. And the pastor, who remains unnamed, said, "Before, when we distributed food among the poor, we were greeted with, 'Here come the infidels.' Mm-hmm. Now they greet us as friends." And he continued, "We wonder why in the midst of all this we feel such peace and such hope. I think it's because God is giving us double grace." And he continues that believers now have a hunger to come closer to God. The church is full of people praying, and that hunger is felt by Muslims as well. God is speaking the language of each group. The blog post concludes that several news media sources have reported numbers of ex-Muslim refugees in Europe that are now coming out as Christians. And some believe that the seeds of those conversions were actually sown when they were still in Syria among this church. So thanks to Christ's sacrifice on the cross, all of us who have accepted his gracious invitation by faith are accounted among the assembly of the firstborn, both now and forever. And one day we will celebrate with the believers of the book of Hebrews, the believers of Aleppo, and the believers of Dresher, PA, worshiping God with reverence and awe for what he has done. I want to close us one of the most reverent songs I can know that captures my feelings about coming to heaven is "Mercy Me's I Can Only Imagine." So I just want to close in a prayer, just paraphrasing some of those words, and then go enjoy your time with your group. I can only imagine what it will be like when I walk by your side. I can only imagine what my eyes will see when your face is before me. Surrounded by your glory, what will my heart feel? Will I dance for you, Jesus? Or in awe of you, be still. Will I stand in your presence, or to my knees will I fall? Will I sing hallelujah? Will I be able to speak at all? I can only imagine when that day comes, when I find myself standing in the sun. I can only imagine when all I would do is forever, forever worship you. Amen. Thank you.